What's going on, people, and welcome back to the Baby Fathers Podcast for another brand new episode. Before I start today's show, there is so much people who watches this show and hasn't subscribed to the channel yet, all right? So if you haven't subscribed to the channel yet, make sure you subscribe to the channel now. Don't forget to give us the thumbs up and don't forget to press the notification buttons anytime an episode comes out. You're going to be the first to know, all right? So I'm your host on the Baby Fathers Podcast and I go by the name of DJ Riddler. And on today's show, we have another special guest, and he goes by the name of Fabian. How are you doing, my bro?
I'm good, thank you, brother. Fabian, I'm representing Fresh for Fathers. That's Fabian requesting equal support holistically for fathers.
Wicked, man. And what brings you down today on the Baby Father?
I'm here today to speak about advocating for fathers to have contact with their children through the family court process and arena.
All right, cool. So before we actually get into that, are we talking about you've had some of the experience yourself?
So I've got personal and professional experience. Mm-hmm. My personal experience, so I'm a single father of two. I have a daughter that's six. I've got a son that's three. And a few years ago, I went through the family court process myself and I represented myself. And having been through the process, kind of identified some of the pitfalls, some of the difficulties and obstacles in the way of fathers or fathers seeking contact. And on a professional level, I'm a social worker that's been qualified since 2016, working in child protection. So I've got kind of view from both sides, really.
Excellent. And when you went to court, you got 50-50. What's the relationship between you and the mother now?
So since having my court order, I would say 80% of the time, things are good. 20% of the time, little hostility that works both ways. But for the most part,
let's start with the court process.
Okay, so the first thing in terms of the court process, you will need to apply for a C100, which is a child arrangements order, and you can apply for that either online or on paper. And basically, there's three elements to that. So there's a child arrangements order, which is about contact, and you'll be highlighting the sort of contact you want, the frequency of contact. There's a prohibited steps order, which will prevent certain things from happening. And then there's a special arrangements order, or specific issues order, rather. And the first part of that process, before you apply for any of those orders, you need to seek mediation. That's a requirement by law. Before, like if you haven't tried to attempt mediation with the mother or father of your children, you're not even going to be able to apply for a court order.
Mm. And to apply for a court order, you have to have PR.
You need to have parental responsibility, yes.
All right, so once they've done that stage, what's the next step?
So you would seek a mediator. They have to be a registered mediator. And basically, once you contact them, they will have a discussion with you about what arrangements you would like to have in place. And then they'll make contact with the mother or father of the child or children. And they will ask them. And I think they will have maybe one or two sessions with each parent before they will then bring you together. And that could be virtually, remotely. And they will try and iron out where there's a middle ground. Because effectively, if there's a middle ground and you can come to some sort of agreement, you don't have to go to court.
And is there a fee involved in that when you go to mediation?
There is a fee in mediation. It does vary. I do believe it's between £100 to £200, but it does vary.
And is that each time you let go?
That's just the whole process.
And is that split between the father and the mother?
ideally, but it's... There's no way of enforcing that. I think the person that applies for mediation, they've got to kind of foot the bill. But the reality is, if you get it through mediation, you've saved yourself thousands and thousands of pounds. So,
okay. All right. So once they've done that, if it obviously doesn't work out, what's the next step after that?
So if it doesn't work out, what they'll put it down to is non-engagement. So let's say they contact the other parent doesn't respond, or they engage and then they disengage, which means they stop responding or they don't attend appointments. I'm not sure what the exact scope is, but maybe like one or two appointments that's missed, or if they explicitly say, look, stop calling my phone, I'm not interested, then the mediation service, they will write a letter which confirms they've attempted mediation, it's not feasible, it's not going to work out, and they give you a stamped and signed letter. But if you are a victim of domestic abuse or violence and you can evidence that, you don't even have to attempt mediation at all. Okay. So once they give you that letter, you need to attach it to your court application and say, you've tried it, it's not worked, we need to go to court.
All right, so when it needs to go to court, is there another application after that now? So you've done a C100.
That's the only application. So, okay. Once you do that, they wouldn't contact you with a court date. So you file the C100, You know, you give your address, you give their address and details that you know, even if you don't know where they live, their number, their email, their date of birth, they'll find them. Obviously, everyone pays taxes or should pay taxes. They'll find them. And then, yeah, basically, you'll both be given a court date. And from that point, that's your first hearing.
All right. And when you go to this first hearing, how does that all work?
So the first hearing is similar, I guess, to like the mediation point, because I think some people, once they get hit with the fact that they're going to go to court, some people are like, do you know what? This is a bit long. I don't really want to go to court. So when you go to your first hearing, the judge will effectively ask, what are you asking? What are you asking? Or what are you not in agreement with? If at that point you've agreed, like, you know what? I just want every other weekend. And the mother or father's like, yeah, they can have every other weekend. The judge might make a decision, but more often than not, there's a little bit of animosity. You could just like, raw, you brought me to court. You're trying to take my kids away. Yeah. So typically after that, you got to file a statement as well with your first hearing to just outline context, background of the relationship, what the current arrangement is, if there is any contact arrangements in place.
So if you're going to court, do you have to put like bullet points what you're going to court for? So you basically, I want overnights the other week. I want to see the child, maybe pick up the child from school once a week. So do you have to outline everything what you're coming to court for?
Yeah, and effectively, I think you need to be as clear and direct with what it is that you're requesting. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a process. So you might have several court hearings. I had 6 in total over the space of 18 months. But obviously what they look at is the status quo. So the status quo is what is typical for the child, what the child is used to. And basically, when you're outlining, when you're presenting your table, if you show from the first statement to the 6th statement, you've been asking for the same thing consistently where the other parent keeps moving the goalposts and changing, that's going to be an indicator to the judge that actually this other parent doesn't really want to compromise on anything. Yeah. So, and also, kind of the other way, don't say you want something if you don't want it, because you might be, are you going to commit to that? Can you really do that? Is that what you really want? Or are you just trying to like one up the other parent? During the period of the court process, where there's no court order in place, you can kind of mess around. I would strongly recommend that you don't mess around, because it's going to weaken your argument and make you just look like you're not serious. Do you know what I mean? But let's say you go through that process and you've committed to doing every weekend or every other weekend, and then you're getting that in the interim, in the meantime, while this process is going on, and then you're not committing to that. When you get to the final hearing, the judge is going to look at you favorably. Mm. But once you get that court order stamped, it's legally binding.
All right, so let me ask this question then, because I was chatting to one of my friends today, and he said to me that he went to court several times. Every time the court put something in place, the mum, and he got what he asked for granted. When it was then to go and pick up his child now, there was a delay, or the child can't come today. Then he had to go back to court. And when it's going back to court, how many times? Because every time, even though this was put in place by the courts, somehow the mum was not complying with what the paperwork was saying. So why is the court not taking that serious?
My experience, I think there's a level of leniency there, which shouldn't be there, because you've come to an agreement. But I've heard it quite often that that kind of happens, and it's costing more money for you to go back and forth and back and forth to court. I can't answer the question. I don't know why they're not taking it as seriously as they should. My argument is, and I will speak about this, I guess, but I would say that there's a level of unconscious bias. I think they make a lot of excuses. And to be fair, I was initially going to say, I think they make a lot of excuses on behalf of mothers, but I have experience from the feedback from a lot of mums messaged me as well. There seems to be this attitude of every parent deserves another chance. Every parent deserves another chance. Maybe they messed up. Maybe they made a mistake. Unless there's a safeguarding risk. So if it's not a safeguarding issue, I think they kind of try again. But my argument to that would be that is emotionally damaging to the child. It's psychological abuse. And I think psychological abuse is probably not explicitly acknowledged as physical abuse is. And that's what I think it is. I think they kind of overlook the impact on the child's well-being. I watched one of your recent podcasts, and I've seen it a few times where it's mentioned like the focus needs to be off the child. And effectively, if you are failing to meet the demands of the court, the agreement of the court, you are failing the child. You might be upsetting the father or the mother, but whichever parent is not sticking to the agreement, like, get over it. Get over it. You might have lost, or you might not have got your way, or you didn't get what you wanted. It is what it is. But I think that's the parent. Whichever parent is not agreeing to what is put in ink and stamped, they're failing the child and they're actually abusing the child, maybe unconsciously.
So if you have been granted and been told this is what you can have, what happens after that?
You sail off into the sunset. Everything from that point should be fine. Mm. In my experience, once I got my court order, everything kind of like calmed down. And I think one of the issues or one of the tensions between myself and the mother of my children was that we were actually in the court process and things got brought up and things got dug up and arguments got raised that we hadn't had with each other, and unresolved issues, basically. Mm. And not only unresolved issues, they're now in the spotlight of social services, the law, do you know what I mean? And it's difficult. And I think people kind of like get their back up. But once that kind of got resolved, it was like, look, we haven't really got an issue to argue anymore. There's still things that are probably unresolved, but the main thing, contact and consistency, stability for the children, that's the main thing, and we've got that.
What made you decide to take your kids 50-50?
Because that's all my children ever knew, and that's all I ever knew. And even in the separation, it took us about 18 months through the court process. And throughout that whole time, it remained 50-50. So that was the status quo. I was fortunate enough to have a flexible enough job where I could still commit to that. So there was not really any reason. I mean, I will be transparent. I don't have entirely 50-50. Mm. So when it went to court, it was agreed it should be 50-50. I have my children Thursday to Monday, that's 4 nights. And then I have them Wednesday to Friday morning. And I could have had them Wednesday to Saturday morning, which would have been exactly 50-50. But I didn't think it would be fair for the children, like, to pick them up the Friday and then the Saturday morning, wake them up and drive them across the town to their mum. I just thought, over the argument of one night, but the holidays are 50-50. So it's as close to 50-50 as possible.
Was there child maintenance involved in all of this? How'd you not split that if you got the kids 50-50?
When you have a lived with order, so let's say you've got 50-50, there are several types of orders you can have. So you can have a lived with one parent, a lived with mother or lived with father order, and then the other parent has a spend time with order. Or you can have a lived with both parents order. And when you have a lived with both parents order, it's exactly 50-50. But even in cases when there's 50-50 care, if the mother, for example, has live with order and the dad has a spend time with, within the child support at 1991, within that act, it actually specifies that the parent that is the non-resident parent, which is the parent that has the spend time with order, they're still financially responsible for providing for the child, even if the care is exactly 50-50, which I think is one of the issues that some fathers do have in the realm of the child maintenance service. I mean, if you have your children the exact same amount of time, why should any exchangement of money be made? And if you have to live with order again, and we're speaking if you have 50-50, if you don't, if you have to live with and you have them 5 nights and he has them 2 nights out of the week, then break the bread. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But if it's 50-50 and you have to live with order, that also means that you're entitled to council housing because you house the children. Whereas the other parent, even if they have the same amount of time, because it's a spend time with order, the local authority or the council will turn and say, well, they've got a permanent home with the parent that has to live with order. And again, even that, it's like, that doesn't really make any sense, but that's the law.
So see how you're like you're an active father, but then also there's some fathers out there sometimes don't want to take the accountability for it.
In terms of accountability, I think so. When I advocate for fathers, and what I will say is this, I don't blindly advocate for fathers. So I hear a lot of, oh, like, she's not letting me see the kids, or oh, this, or oh, that. Social services, this and that. Look, give me the information. Give me the social services reports. Give me the CAFCAS report. Give me, like, what is actually being said. What is your police record? Oh, no, nothing. Oh, but this one time, actually, and oh, this other time, like, be transparent. And I find with those fathers that aren't transparent, that aren't honest, I can't support them. And I'm not going to advocate on their behalf, because at the end of the day, if you're not going to be honest with someone that is actually trying to help you out of this situation, like, where are we going with this? So I think the first step, and the thing is as well, like, I can't speak for everyone, but for most people, and myself included, I've done things that I'm not proud of or things that I do regret. But if you don't hold yourself accountable, you're restricting yourself from growth. You can't grow if you can't identify, do you know what? Actually, I did wrong. Do you know what I mean? And I guess there's an anxiety about how the judge might take that or how someone might interpret that. Like when I spoke with Kafkas myself, they asked me certain questions and they asked me, had I exposed the children to situations that caused them distress? And I said, no. And then I said, actually, do you know what? I did argue with their mum a few times and I could imagine that wasn't nice for them. And do you know what I mean?
Of course.
And I still got the outcome that I sought. So you got to be honest with yourself. If you can't even be honest with yourself, then...
But do you think when they're asking them kind of questions, if you're not honest, they can still detect it and they're able to find out?
I think you got to work on the basis that they might already know. They might not know, but they might already know. And I guess if you're looking at they might know everything and they might know nothing, and then your children are right in the center of that, do you want to roll the dice on that? Because if you withhold information and don't tell the full truth and they do know, like, you're going to lose out much more. I would say you're going to lose out much more than if you owned it.
For mothers, like, I want to get your view on this, like mothers who are holding their kids back from the father, if there's no safeguarding issue, what's your understanding and how do you see that?
I guess one of the fundamental things to look at is the circumstances of why the relationship broke down. There might be some bitterness, there might be some resentment towards the father in that case. But even if that mother broke up the relationship, so for whatever reason, the point is that they're withholding contact from the child, you're harming the child. You're harming the father by proxy, but the first person that gets hurt is the child. Now, I guess there's some situations where the father might be inconsistent or has never, in their eyes, been a good enough dad or a good enough father. But the child will come to learn that in time. You need to make sure that you do everything in your power to allow the child to see the dad for who the dad is. Because the dad might be a piece of garbage. But if you keep preventing the child from seeing that, as much as on one level you want to protect your child, you're actually doing yourself a disservice, because that child's resentment that they may rightfully have targeted towards the dad, you're standing between them and the dad. So that resentment that they should target towards the dad is actually being targeted at you. You need to let them see for itself. And I've seen it within my family. I've seen it within friends. I've seen it a lot. And basically what ends up happening is you have a child that grows up that hates their mum. And actually, you know, I could kind of rationalize and understand why the mum did do that, but the child doesn't understand that, and it takes a long time for that healing or that damage to be undone.
A father doesn't check for his child. Do you agree that a mother can behave in terms of not allowing that child to have access to the father?
I would say it depends what the father is doing. If the father is inconsistent, like, see my dad, yeah? He's probably going to watch this, yeah? See my dad, yeah? My dad was late to everything. Always, always late. Yes, late, yeah? But he would always turn up. He would always turn up. So it got to a point when I got older, I used to laugh like, oh, yeah, he's going to be late. He's going to be late. But he would always turn up. And when it was important things, he was always there. And if I needed him, I could call on him and I could depend on him. Mm. If I call my dad now, he would come from Quay 4 or 5 hours away. He'd come here, do you know what I mean? So I think you got to find the right balance, because on the one hand, you need to instill boundaries. You need to have firm boundaries. I think it depends on the age of the child as well. But I think you need to leave that door open. And it can be disheartening when you're left dealing with a child of the father that didn't turn up. I can imagine that must be hard. But I think until it reaches a point where it's actually damaging and hurting the child, you need to let it play its course.
And mothers who take fathers to CSA?
If you have a father that you know is active in the child's life and is actually going to provide what the child needs, you need to let that man do what he needs to do. Do you know what I mean? But if this guy isn't turning up and he's not spending that quality time with his children, he's not investing that time with his children, he's not nurturing them, he's not helping them grow, he's not teaching and educating them, then by all means, child maintenance. And again, you know, on the balance of time, if the time is like 70% to mum and 30% to dad, like, he needs to put his hand in his pocket. I'm a strong advocate. You got to provide for your child. They're your children at the end of the day. You don't want your child going to bed with an hungry belly. But I think there are ways that can be avoided. But it comes down to amicability and, I guess, maturity. But at the same time, if the mum needs that money, and you know in your heart of hearts you need that money, you shouldn't feel any sort of shame or any type of way in asking for that money. And you shouldn't feel any sort of way to release that money either.
But what about is when it's the father who, it was already given a certain amount of money, but the mum was demanding even more, and that's why she went there.
There's a sort of like a level of entitlement, I think, where it's like, rah, I've got this person's children, man needs to give me the peace. When actually, like, that relationship's over for whatever reason, you need to stand on your own two feet and do what you need to do. I tell my sisters this all the time, all the time. If you're not prepared to have those children by yourself, do you really want to have those children? We can argue all day long about what a dad should do, what he should do for his children, what he should provide, and I agree. But there's no guarantee that he's going to. So if you're not prepared to go it alone and do it by yourself, and I guess there's always going to be this fear about, no. Reality, like ideals and reality are two very different things. And the reality is that man might dip out and leave you and your children on the side of the curb. And that's wrong for many reasons. I don't advocate, I don't endorse that. But that being the reality, I say it all the time. If men could get pregnant instead of women, I think men would be very, very selective about carrying children to term.
Yeah.
How the child maintenance service system is broken down. When they make a calculation, they make it based off X amount of days or nights spent with each parent, right? And then basically they make their calculation based off of that, but also off of the paying parents' gross income. So first of all, you're making a calculation on gross income. So that's the income before tax has even been taken out. So you're talking about money that this person hasn't even received, which I think is quite unjust, if I'm to be quite frank. Do you have with the child maintenance service is that they don't factor into the paying parents' necessary expenses. So they don't factor into the paying parents' rent. They don't factor into their travel. They don't factor into their gas, their electric, their debts, if they have any debts, student loan debts, or whatever debts. We're talking compulsory spending. So we're not talking about spending whatever a man wants to spend to look this and that. Just like compulsory spending. And I think to have a fair and balanced decision and agreement about what payments should be made, those things should be factored into. They also don't acknowledge the receiving parent's income. So the receiving parent, they could actually earn twice as much as the paying parent. Their children might be in full-time education. So in theory, they could work full-time. Do you know what I mean? They could have a sister or a mother or an aunt that can actually look after the children. So they could actually have a full-time job, have a high-paying salary, higher income. And I know that might not be the case for everyone, but let's just say they can, or they're able to do so. They don't factor into the receiving parent's income. And I think decisions should be based on the amount of time spent with each parent. That's valid. That makes sense. But also the receiving parent's income and the paying parent's expenditure. Because, you know, I looked at some stats, like on an income salary of about 32K, I think it's something like 2,180 per month after tax. For two children, at six nights a month, that's every other weekend, that's an average of 1 to 2 nights per month. They have to pay £364 for the children. And then I looked at the average one-bedroom private accommodation in South London, and that was £1,500. So when you talk about £1,500 plus the £364, that's nearly £1,900. And you're talking about they're earning an income of £2,180. Like, so if the shoe was on the other foot, how do you expect that person to live when they're like, they got £200, £300? They've got less disposable income after, but those are things that really need to be looked into. Like when the receiving parent receives the money, no one can dictate to that parent how they spend that money. I know there's this argument, she spends it on hair, she spends it on, listen, you don't know what she does the rest of the month and how she manages her money. And I agree with that. No one should be able to dictate how she spends that money. But why can a third party dictate how the paying parent spends his money?
I agree. So do you think that if a dad asks the mother to see receipts for what she spent the money on, do you think he has a right to do that?
I don't think he has a right to do that, because I think that just causes further conflict and tension between the parents. And myself and the mother of my children, we've got a good parenting relationship. We don't speak much outside of that. And I think that opens up the door for more communication than is actually necessary. The reason why I think things work between me and the mother of my children is because communication is so minimal. Mm-hmm. And in my experience of parents that actually get along for the most part, it's because they live two separate lives and they just get on. When you're talking about you want to go through this, and then what happens? They get receipts and then you're not happy with how they spent that money. Then what? Like it just opens up the door for too much hostility and arguments, I think.
Well, me personally, I don't think there's anything wrong either way. I think if a father does ask to see receipts, me personally, there shouldn't be an issue with the mum to produce the receipts. If he's asked for the receipts, if it's for good intentions, where there's no, if it's not a tit for tat. But at the same time, I don't think that a father should feel a type of way to ask a mum to see receipts.
Yeah, I do take your point because at the end of the day, if she is doing what she's meant to be doing by her child or the children, then that shouldn't be an issue. But again, I go back to the point of, but then if she's not, by your standards, then what happens off of that? They submit. When you get universal credit, does universal credit ask for the receipts of what you're spending your money on?
I don't know.
I assume not.
So the court system, as you have been involved in it, is it broken to you?
I wouldn't say explicitly that the system is broken. I would say there are elements that need reform, and specifically in relation to those three services that I mentioned, and this is something that I'm very passionate about, there needs to be more representation of men within these services. Not to dominate or overpower or to turn it on its head, but these services are predominantly occupied by women, and I think women understand women and they don't necessarily understand men as much. And I think there needs to be more of a balance with anything: man, woman, masculine, feminine, boy, girl, adult, child. There needs to be balance. Life is about balance, and if you have any system where there is imbalance, it's not going to work. Do you know what I mean?
So you said that you got a 3-year-old son. If he got older, and for obviously touch wood, if he got older now and his situation never worked out, would you say to him to go to the court to go and fight for his kids?
100%. If you don't turn up, you can't be counted. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's people that have gone through the process and not got what they saw, and that is an unfortunate reality. But you can't, like, I hear a lot of the time, oh yeah, well, I'll just wait until they're 18, man. You missed out 15, 16 years of your child's life. So if it was my son, get your legality. Like, stand up, stand firm and advocate for yourself. Do you know? Not even advocate for yourself, advocate for your child. If you truly believe that your child deserves their mother as well as their father to equal amounts, well, what are you doing about it? And until all the doors have been slammed in your face, you can't really turn and say that the system's not fair. Because the system, I'm sure you see it in your comments a lot. There's a lot of people, oh, it's not fair, it's this and that. But there are also a lot of positive outcomes that do come out of that process. And I think the more people that actually go to court and fight for their rights and stand up for themselves, the more you're going to see a shift. It's like if you turn and say, oh, well, you know, like, women aren't too interested in doing bricklaying, for example. But have you targeted the marketing at women and given opportunities for women to try bricklaying? Like, if you don't put that opportunity out there, you can't turn and say that people aren't interested in it. And if you don't turn up and try to pursue it, then you can't say that you're not going to get it. I think it's a cop-out. It's an easy way to just turn and say, yeah, well, you know how social services, you know how judges are, like, that doesn't mean anything, man.
You're saying that if you do it the right way and you do go for the right channels, you're more likely to come out on the other side and get what you asked for.
Yeah, you're more likely to, on the basis of probability, on the basis of chance, you're more likely to, innit? Like, if you try, you're more likely to. Like, I applied for a job, my first social work job, I applied for it, I was heavily, heavily underqualified. And when I went to the interview, they said to me, you're not qualified for this job, you need like X amount of experience and X amount of training. But they offered me a different job. And then I worked up to that job that I applied for. Now, if I didn't turn up for the interview,
you wouldn't have got nowhere.
You see what I'm saying? So you got to try, man. Something's got to give.
Okay. So to any fathers out there who wants to go through the process, what would you say to them?
I would say that the process is much more straightforward than you might think it is. It is anxiety inducing. It is mentally taxing. It is emotionally draining. It's not an easy thing to do, but there's a lot of other ways you can expend your energy and your time that are less fruitful. I think there is nothing more important than playing a significant and pivotal role in your child's life. And I would say, do your research, read, seek support. There are support services out there. There might not be that many, but there are out there. And I think particularly on social media, there are a lot more people advocating for fathers to be involved. And I think now's a good time for transition of change. Put yourself forward and put yourself out there for your kids.
And to the fathers who are just sitting on the fence, who just saying, oh, I'm going to wait till the child gets a certain age before I get involved in that child's life.
If you were 5 years old, what would you turn and say when you turn 18 and your dad turns up and was like, yo, what's going on? What would you say to him? That's what I would say. What would you actually say to him? Would you hear him say, oh, about your mom, or oh, about social services? Or, would you hear that? Because I don't think you would hear that. So just have that in your head, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. All right, my brother, time's up. I'm going to say thank you for coming down today. Is there anything you want to say before we finish?
I'd just like to say thanks for having me. Again, I don't blindly advocate for fathers. I advocate for families with the children at the focus. So mothers, fathers, particularly your mothers, because a lot of dads do speak to me. Mums, don't feel any type of way about seeking advice or information from me. Advice is free, knowledge is power. We want to raise the children of tomorrow to be better than the children of today. Yeah, that's what I'd like to say.
Okay. Cool, my brother. So listen, I want to hear your lot's views today in the comments below. Make sure you subscribe to the channel and don't forget to press that notification button. So anytime an episode comes out, you're going to be the first to know. And don't forget to give us the likes for this video, all right? So for myself, DJ Riddler, and Fabio.
Fabian,
so am I, guys.
You don't have to edit that out. You can keep that in.
All right. Peace.
Bless.
And we out, man.